Episode 86, Stonewall Jackson and the First Battle of Bull Run. Hi, my name is Clayton Mills. Welcome to A Short Walk Through Our Long History, a podcast where we look at the events of history and examine how those events shaped our modern world. Well, here we are at war, sort of. Shots were fired at Fort Sumter, but no one was actually killed in the battle. But now the battle lines are being drawn. Lincoln has asked for more volunteers, and the border states of Arkansas, Missouri, Tennessee, and most importantly, Virginia, have chosen to leave the Union rather than to provide troops that could be used to attack the South. So both sides begin putting together armies. A lot of men volunteered initially, in part because they thought it wasn't going to take that long. Lincoln's original request for new volunteers, for example, was only for a 90-day enlistment. People in both the North and the South felt like this war would be over in just a couple of months. Both sides overestimated their own battle prowess, and they felt like they'd be able to whip the other side pretty easily. They use the word whip a lot when they're talking about battles. But even more than that, both sides seriously underestimated the other side's resolve to fight. The Southerners felt like all they would have to do is defend themselves from a few Northern attempts at invasion, and that the North would then quit and let them go. The Northerners felt like all they had to do was build a big army and march it back and forth and then march it into the South at least once, and then the South might capitulate without even any fighting. Boy, both sides are about to be proved way wrong. As I mentioned last episode, one of the issues that was facing both sides was that they were both short on officers who had any real battle experience. A lot of the experienced officers were from the South, and so those officers went home to serve in their state militia, leaving the North with a shortage of good officers. The most notable of these officers that left was Robert E. Lee of Virginia. Lee is going to be given command of the largest state militia, and also he raises more volunteers for it. This militia becomes known as the Army of Northern Virginia, and it's destined to become the most effective fighting force since Napoleon. The Army of Northern Virginia's main objective was going to be to protect Richmond, which was the capital of Virginia, and soon would become the capital of the Confederacy. Richmond was only 100 miles away from Washington, D.C., so it was pretty vulnerable to a Union invasion, which Virginia was sure was coming soon. Now, just across the Potomac River, the main Union army was known as the Army of the Potomac. Again, its main job was to protect Washington, but Lincoln also wanted to use it to attack the South and to capture Richmond. The Union general who had been the commander at the start of the war was General Winfield Scott. We mentioned him in the episode about the Mexican-American War. He's one of the guys who invaded Mexico. But by the start of the Civil War, he was too old to really be expected to lead troops in a real battle. So Lincoln asked Scott to appoint a successor. The first person Scott asked was actually Robert E. Lee, who turned him down, saying he could not participate in an invasion of his own home state of Virginia. So he went back to Richmond, and only a few days later, he was given command of the Army of Northern Virginia. Since Lee had said no, General Scott appointed one of his most trusted advisors, a guy named General Irvin McDowell. Now, McDowell had a reputation at that point as being a military intellectual who knew a lot about military history and strategy. But as we're about to see, that was all book knowledge, and it's not going to translate into actual battle very well. McDowell spent several months getting the army ready, but Lincoln and most of Washington thought he was dawdling and that he needed to get moving. Wait till they see McClellan. Oh my gosh, that guy was a grandmaster McDawdler. Well, General McDowell thought that the army was still too green or not ready, and they needed more training, and he was probably right about that. But under pressure from Lincoln and from just about everybody else, he agrees to set out with an army of about 35,000 men, most of whom are really very new as soldiers, as are his officers. On the southern side, just over a day's march away, is a Confederate army led by General P.G.T. Beauregard. PGT stands for Pierre Gustave Toutant Beauregard, and his family was from Louisiana of French descent. PGT turns out to be one of the most capable generals in the entire war, definitely one of the most capable in the South, although he didn't get along very well with the other generals, including Lee, and he did not get along with Jefferson Davis. General PGT Beauregard had about 22,000 Confederate troops against the 35,000 that are coming with McDowell. Just across the border from Washington was the town of Manassas, Virginia, where there was an important railroad junction. And when I say just across the border, I mean it was really close to Washington, D.C., less than a day's ride on horseback. Today, nowadays, Manassas is basically a suburb of Washington, D.C. The railroad junction in Manassas was the first target of the Union Army, though the prevailing expectation in Washington was that the Army was going to be able to march relatively easily all the way to Richmond, capture the city, and end the war. PGT Beauregard and the Southern armies had other ideas. Their job was to protect Manassas and the railway junction and keep the Union Army out of Virginia. Beauregard had his troops deployed in a line that sort of ran from southeast to northwest, out in front of Manassas. Beauregard had also received information about McDowell's intention from a network of spies in Washington, and that network is going to provide information to the South all throughout the war. A reconnaissance group sent out by McDowell met an outpost of Confederate troops on July 18th. Shots were fired, but there were no casualties. McDowell and the Union soldiers now had a sense of where the Confederates were and some sense of the Confederate defenses. So McDowell decided to move to his right, which would be the Confederate left flank, and try to get around behind the Confederate lines. This is a wise move, right? You go around the people and attack them from behind. So McDowell moves his force over to a field next to a creek that is known as Bull Run, trying to get around the Confederate lines. Now we have to get to here something that's going to be an ongoing problem of the Civil War, and that is that the Union and the Confederacy, besides not agreeing on slavery or states' rights, also could not agree on how to name their battles. The Confederates tended to name the battle after the nearest town, but the Union tended to name the battles after a geographic feature in the area. So, this first major battle that's about to happen is going to be known in the South as the First Battle of Manassas, but in the North, it's going to be known as the First Battle of Bull Run. This is not to be confused with the Second Battle of Manassas or the Second Battle of Bull Run, which will happen later. For the sake of clarity in this podcast, I'm usually going to go with just the Union name, since that's kind of the accepted historical standard nowadays, but I may also mention the Confederate names of battles too, you know, just so you know. So McDowell wisely moves his men to the Confederate left flank, trying to go around their dug-in positions. But he does this so slowly, taking more than 4 full days to make the move, that the Confederates were able to call up reinforcements, who arrived by train and began to set up shop out there on the left flank. This group of reinforcements was led by General Albert Sidney Johnston, who was from Tennessee, but who had also served in the Army of the Texas Republic. When Johnston and his men arrived, several of Johnston's brigades were sent to hold some important high ground, which was known as Henry House Hill. McDowell, the Union general, sent a diversionary force to make a fake attack on a bridge that was known as the Stone Bridge, but that attack was so poorly executed that the Confederates saw it to be a fake, and they didn't commit any extra troops to that area. McDowell then began his main assault on the Confederate line at several places. But in many places, the units were not coordinated with each other, and so several of the attacks failed. In some places, the Union troops were gaining ground. At Henry House Hill, the Union soldiers made some substantial headway, and some of the Confederate troops began to retreat. One Confederate general, a guy named General Bernard Bee, saw a single regiment of Virginia militia, led by General Thomas Jackson, holding their ground against the Union forces. Bee, in order to rally his troops back into the battle, told them, "Look, men, look at Jackson standing there like a stone wall." Bee and the other Confederate officers were able to turn their men around and push back the Union troops from Henry House Hill. and the nickname that had been given to General Jackson stuck, Stonewall Jackson. Now that is a heck of a nickname. Jackson would go on to become Lee's second in command for a long stretch of the war, and while they were together, they never lost a battle. But Jackson would later be accidentally wounded by fire from his own men, and he would die 8 days after being shot. That's coming later. In this battle, Confederate reinforcements arrived again and stopped the Union from gaining any ground. After holding the line all day, at around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, General Beauregard, the Confederate general, ordered an attack all across the line. The Confederate soldiers jumped out of their dug-in positions and they ran at the Union lines screaming a high-pitched battle cry that became known as the Rebel Yell. The Union lines collapsed all along the line. Union soldiers began to retreat and then they began to run back in the general direction of Washington. But the road to Washington was packed with civilians, including senators and congressmen and women who had come out to watch the battle. Soon there was general chaos all along the road back to Washington, and McDowell's army withdrew completely, leaving Beauregard and the Confederates the victors. Now, Beauregard, for his part, did not pursue, partly because his army was too scattered to control, and so he brought them all back to their defensive positions. This infuriated Jefferson Davis, who had actually also come out from Richmond to watch the battle. If Beauregard had pursued and really destroyed McDowell's army, there was no organized army between him and Washington, and Beauregard and this army might have been able to capture Washington and end the war. But instead, both sides left the battlefield and went back to tend their wounded and get reorganized. Maybe part of the reason Beauregard didn't pursue was that he and everyone were just shocked at how violent and how costly the battle had already been. Instead of a quick and easy win, there were thousands and thousands of dead soldiers on the field. The Confederates had about 1,700 casualties, and the Union had about 3,000. I guess I should say a word right now about the word casualties, because I'll be using it a lot in the next couple of episodes. Casualties is a term you usually hear after battle, usually in the context of which side had the most casualties. The term doesn't mean the number of dead. It actually means the number of dead, plus the number of those injured too severely to fight on anymore, plus the number of missing soldiers after the battle. So to break this one down a little further, the Union had 481 killed, 1,011 wounded, and 1,216 missing. That's a lot of missing soldiers, by the way. Lots of people ran home. The Confederates had 387 killed, 1,582 wounded, but only 13 missing. And you sort of see the discrepancy in the commitment of the sides at the beginning of the war. Manassas was the first major battle on American soil since the War of 1812, and in terms of raw numbers of soldiers, it was, at the time, the largest battle in the history of the American continent. It was also the bloodiest day in American history up to that point. The battle had been seen by spectators from both the North and the South, and they were shocked by the carnage and the ferocity of the fighting and by the number of the casualties. The Union forces and the Northern press were surprised at how fiercely the rebels, as they now called them, fought. People began to see for the first time that this might not be an easy war. There were some important repercussions from this battle that affected the early course of the war. First of all, General McDowell was removed as the commander of the Army of the Potomac, which again is the main Union army. He was replaced by General George McClellan, who is going to be one of the best liked but worst remembered generals of the war. Everyone liked him, but everybody who looks back on him as a military strategist goes, man, he was awful. McClellan, it's going to turn out, is good at organizing and putting together an impressive army, one that looks great in a parade, but he's really, really slow to get that army anywhere near a battle. And when he does, he's so tentative that he will always get beat. Perhaps McClellan was sensitive to all the criticism that came on the army after the embarrassing loss at Bull Run. So maybe he wasn't fighting to win, really. He was fighting to not lose in such an embarrassing way. And that's not going to work if you're trying to invade and subdue a group of rebellious states. It's almost going to cost the Union the war. And Lincoln and McClellan will be at odds the whole time that McClellan's in charge. In the South, the repercussion of the Battle of Manassas, see what I did there, was that the Southerners got a bit complacent. And instead of pushing the battle into Washington, where they could have possibly ended the war quickly because Washington was disorganized, the army was disorganized, instead they just rested behind their defenses, confident that the Union would never be able to best them. That was a mistake. And honestly, it is going to be a while before the Union does actually best them anywhere. It's going to take a grouchy, shy, rumpled, antisocial general and a lot more casualties to finally earn a Union victory. Join us next episode for Ulysses Grant and the Battle of Shiloh.